This is the L2 Capital Podcast with hedge fund manager Marcelo Lopez. The L2 Capital Podcast focuses on potential opportunities in the market and brings to your industry leaders and an intelligent conversation about their respective areas of expertise. And now, here's your host, Marcelo Lopez.
And welcome to the L2 Capital Podcast. I'm very excited today to talk to Aaron Edelheit. I have been talking to Aaron for over a year now, and I almost met him last year in California where he lives, but my flight got canceled and we couldn't meet. But we kept in touch and I'm very pleased with that. I learned a lot about cannabis with Aaron. He's got a very different view of the sector, and I can say that he's one of the brightest minds in the cannabis space. Like we at L2 Capital, Aaron likes to look for opportunities. He's heavily invested in the sector, and we are going to find out why. So without further ado, Aaron, welcome to this program. It's a great pleasure to have you here and to talk to you again.
Thank you so much, Marcelo, and you make me blush with the kind words, so thank you.
Aaron, one of the things I like about you is that you are always looking for opportunities, and you do a deep dive in whatever sector you're interested in. You run money and you have your own money at stake when you find these opportunities. And I think this is super important. One has to have an alignment of interest with his or her clients. But anyway, I'm not going to be talking about you. I'll let you introduce yourself and tell us what you do.
Yeah, so I'm an investor and I love finding kind of undiscovered opportunities or opportunities that are obscured some way, or there's some barrier to other people investing. And I've always loved it. And I'm not a really good trader. I don't like day trading. It's just very stressful for me or doing stuff like that. I really love the research process, getting to know companies, trying to form an opinion, and then, oh no, my opinion is wrong, and refining it and doing research. And then that's the value. And then they're just kind of sharing the story, sharing my research with others, investing, and then watching to see if I'm right. I just love it. So I've been doing it for like 25 years. In between, I had what was a side project of buying foreclosed homes, fixing them up and renting them out. And that became a massive business. So like, you know, for me, when we talk about cannabis, and I believe I've shared this with you, is when I first started buying foreclosed homes in 2009, people looked at me like I had a third eyeball. And I remember being on the courthouse steps in Atlanta, Georgia, in December of 2011, and looking around and being like, how is it that no one's here? How am I by myself? And I get the same feeling right now in cannabis, that outside of you and a handful of other kind of professional investors who have started peeling back the onion and looking at this very, very large industry, that it's a mess and there's a lot of chaos going on. We all see just a tremendous amount of opportunity, and the barrier, because about 99, if not 99.9% of the smartest people in the world are not allowed to or cannot invest in the sector. It is like the same thing of being on the courthouse steps in Atlanta and wondering, where are all the institutions? And I have the same feeling right now.
Yep, I agree. So Aaron, why invest in cannabis?
So one thing, so what initially kind of drove me to this is, I'm driven in ways, and I'm kind of a workaholic in ways that I don't really understand. And I think that leads to an overactive mind and brain. And I suffer through bouts of insomnia. I don't know, Marcelo, if you suffer from this, but I wouldn't wish it on my own worst enemy. I have three small kids, and a low dose cannabis gummy has kind of been life altering to me. And what I can do is now, I can take it for a couple of days. I wake up, I have no side effects, I have no grogginess. And then my sleep pattern kind of gets reset and I'm fine. And I just, now just knowing it's in my cabinet, or if I traveled, hotel room, you know, I'm on business, whatever, it is life altering. And it kind of then I just started researching the space, and it's so utterly fascinating that I'm obsessed with it now, to be honest, because it's so complicated and so interesting. And there's so many different layers. You basically, because it's, and what I'm interested in, by the way, is right now is I'm talking about US cannabis, and sure. and I want to distinguish that from the Canadian cannabis companies, which are, have been on this huge hype and boom and bust cycle. But just so you know, it's like Canada, it's federally legal in Canada. And because of that, companies can trade in the US that have no operations in the US. But Canada by itself is smaller than all of California. And so in the US, because it's federally illegal, but because it's state legal, so there's this conflict between the federal government and the state government where they're federal government's kind of looking the other way, like, we don't know what to do with this. And the states are like, yeah, keep going. And every state has its own rules and regulations. You have wildly different systems. And it's kind of like this grand experiment going on. And cannabis is not allowed to cross state lines. So you, it's just this incredibly complicated, intricate business. It's very difficult. And then because of the federal illegality, very few institutions can invest, and they can't custody the shares of publicly traded stocks. And so U.S. operators have been forced to list on secondary or tertiary Canadian exchanges or over-the-counter exchanges that are wildly illiquid. And they have very limited access to capital. And you've just, it's just this mess. But in the meantime, you have this $100 billion revenue business, and about, I don't know, 60 or 70 billion of it is what you consider illicit. And then the rest is state legal, and more states are legalizing. And not only are almost all the states have a medical program, but 23 of the states have adult use, full adult use. And it's, to me, as a researcher, one, there's very little competition for research in terms of due diligence. And I have, you know, examples that I can share. I was like, how do I know this? Like, if this was any other industry, you'd have some massive hedge fund that would know it, you know, way before me. And how come no one's writing about this or talking about it? And it's just really, really interesting. So you have a lot of turmoil, a lot of chaos, but you have companies that are growing really fast and have just kind of a really big opportunity with few investors. And so, and just not a lot of clarity about the industry and how it actually functions. Yep. So to me, to a person that loves research and finding hidden opportunity, this is like, I'm like a kid in a candy store.
Yeah. Yeah. So you see similarities in cannabis today in the real estate markets in the US in 2009, right?
Well, yeah, no. So it's that I see almost no institutional participation. And because there's no institutional participation, there's almost no research. And so you find these disparities that are just where people don't understand. You know, now in the US, there are very large corporations that own tens of thousands of homes. I think Blackstone, their Invitation Homes, own something like 80 or 90,000 homes that they rent out. Well, before 2009, no one did that. No one did it at scale. And there was a belief that you couldn't do it. There wasn't like an apartment. And I see the same thing in cannabis. And what's so fascinating is the views on cultivation is many people believe that you could just grow cannabis anywhere. It's super easy to grow. And because it's super easy to grow, it's a commodity, can't generate much value in it. And you can, there's no margin. And so why would you do it? Eventually it's all going to go down to like, be like corn or broccoli or something. And when you do research in the space, you find, oh, wow, this is actually incredibly difficult. And some people think it's actually impossible to grow. And what I'm talking about is grow high quality cannabis consistently at scale. And so it's really interesting, kind of the similarities where before 2018, we never really grew cannabis at scale before. That's the other part. So no one's ever really, as a society, we've never really done this before. And not so legally, not legally, but no one really at scale has been doing it, because you'd have before 2018, if you really grew it at scale, you were a giant target. to be prosecuted. And so we can look to the north in Canada and watch these companies spectacularly implode from trying to grow cannabis, throwing billions of dollars at it, huge facilities, and still having failed harvests. And then you can see U.S. companies trying it and failing or succeeding when there's limited licenses. But when the minute there's competition, there's no profit in it. And so it's super interesting to just see the struggle on the basic farming. And this goes to what my research shows is that cannabis, to grow it consistently at scale, is, I think, cannabis 1.0, because it turns out that the flower, the bud that you smoke, has no skin. It has no protection. And because of that, it's incredibly susceptible to disease, pests, mold, and it's like trying to grow an apple without its skin. And so this is why most cannabis is done indoors, because you need like perfect environment. You ever see pictures of people who work in there? They have like hazmat suits on. It's not to protect them. It's to protect the plant. And so it's just super interesting, the complexity of the actual farming and how at odds that is with the main perception that is out there.
Got it. Now, cannabis stocks in the U.S. are very cheap. Why do you think people are not paying attention to the sector? And if I may put another question to you, what do you think are the biggest problems facing U.S. cannabis today?
So one of the things, the biggest thing is that you had a giant boom in 2020, late 2020 and 2021, when they thought federal reform was going to happen. And federal reform did not happen. And they've been kind of playing, using it as a political football, the different parties, and nothing has gotten done. And so the combination of that big boom, interest rates rising, all speculative assets getting kicked out, you had the main index, most cannabis stocks just got destroyed. And now people look at cannabis and they're like, federal reform may never happen. They may be right. And so, but then at the same time, a lot of the leading cannabis companies had been showing really strong growth because they were operating in limited license markets. And then as those limited license markets matured and no new markets turned on, growth went away. And that combination of, you've been an investor before, when companies stop growing, multiples do some pretty terrible thing. Valuations go down. And then a lot of them went on a land grab, took on an enormous amount of debt. And so the combination of slowing or flat cash flow, multiples coming down with debt loads going up, have really crushed valuations with basically no federal reform happening. And so that's where we leave it today. And that's the opportunity that you and I look in, is even of the few investors, so many people have gotten hit and blown apart. Everyone's like, I don't want any part of this. This is too hard. I was wrong. I'm out. And at the same time, the industry is still growing. States are still legalizing. Companies are starting to emerge from some of the wreckage. But when you ask what the biggest problem that I see, and I don't really see a lot of people talking about this, the biggest problem I see are the interstate commerce restrictions, where cannabis cannot cross state lines. And so what we've done is we've forced companies that want to operate in multiple states, and they're normally known as multi-state operators, to basically try and duplicate their production facilities in every single state. And so you have some wildly weird stuff going on, like 10% of Massachusetts' electricity grid is used for cultivation. You know, it's going to be like the heat index in South Florida right now is something like north of 100, or it's like 95 and like 90% humidity. And why are we growing cannabis indoors in Florida right now? Why would you be growing cannabis in Minnesota or New York or, you know, all year round? I'm looking outside right now in Santa Barbara. It's 75 degrees and there's a nice ocean breeze coming in. And it's sunny like 320 days of the year with perfect ideal temperature. And it's like what's produced in California, what's produced in Oregon or Washington, or even parts of Arizona, cannot cross state lines. And so you have different market. You have companies that are been forced to do these complicated things, trying to reproduce assets in multiple states and produce and farm indoors in places you shouldn't. And then because of the rules there, a lot of these companies have had to do multiple things at once, like be the farmer, be the distributor, be the manufacturer edibles, run their own kitchen, then be retail, then try to build brands in like 10 or 15 states. It hurts my brain just trying to think about that, all with different rules, right? And so it's like chaos. It's like managing chaos. And so you normally, you know, you have companies that can be just branded plays, or you have companies that be like, oh, we're the contract manufacturer, we're the farming expert, or, you know, the cultivator. And you'd have companies that excelled at edibles, for example, or drinks, and they would all be specialized. You'd have some hybrid plays, but you don't have any of that. And then you have these weird things where, like, you can grow high quality cannabis in a greenhouse for like $700, and you can buy it for like $700-$800 a pound. And then in East Coast markets where it's limited licenses, it'll sell for thousands of dollars. And you have price differential, quality differential. And it's just what it's done is the interstate commerce restrictions has encouraged illicit activity, where it's like, well, if you can buy a product of that is great quality at this price, and then all you got to do is ship it over to another state, and it's 3 to 5x the price, you're going to encourage some enterprising people to take advantage of that. And then those people who are in those limited licenses are going to complain, why is there so much? Why won't people buy our overpriced, mediocre cannabis? Why don't the officials stop this? And it, to me, it comes down to these interstate commerce restrictions, which eventually I believe will go away. And then you'll have a healthier supply chain, lower cost cannabis that companies can then choose to be, oh, we're great at retailing, or we're great at taking the raw materials and making it into great products, or, you know, some combination of that. But you won't force everybody into the most capital intensive activity that requires perfect environment and precision technology.
Right, right. Now, listen, that interstate is a very interesting topic, and I'm going to go back to it later on. But you mentioned federal reform. Would that be unfair to say that cannabis is a play on politics? Because it's talking about legislation, which depends entirely on politicians and not about the opportunities in the sector.
Oh, you can't ignore the federal. Part of my thesis is just a question of when, not if, and that the problem at the federal government is they don't know how to do it. They want to do some version of it, but you have people on the left that want a lot of like social equity, repair of the war on drugs, and a lot of people on the right want restrictions, but more open, you know, more traditional kind of business. Or you have some people who are like, I don't really like this. I don't want it that legal. I want it a lot of restrictions. So it's a question, and in a very fractured political times where they can't agree on anything, is this just, and the other problem that cannabis has is it doesn't really rise to the level of other issues that drive out the vote or get people impassioned. Like, cannabis is a very popular issue, but it's not like one of these supercharged ones that each party can go to their base and be like, did you see what they said or that? And so it's created this weird dynamic where it's very popular. The states keep legalizing it, but the federal government is kind of paralyzed. But it's absolutely a play on it, because you need it to cut. Right now, it's classified as a Schedule I drug, according to the Controlled Substances Act, which means it has no medicinal value. And it's classified as more dangerous than fentanyl, which is absurd. And so you need that for it to become not illegal, so that more investment capital can come in. And so that's why people really focused on what the federal government, you know, whether it's safe banking, that it gives the banks, potentially investors, cover so that they won't, the federal government won't target them. The thing that I'm more focused on is the Biden administration last October initiated a scheduling review of cannabis. And I believe they're going to move by year end. They're start the process to remove it from Schedule One, but it is very much a play on federal reform because right now there's no cap, there's very little capital in there, and the companies that want to grow just don't really have adequate access to capital, and sure. you have this kind of weird system because it's federally illegal. The main reason that states have enacted interstate commerce restrictions is because of the federal illegality. So a lot of this, the whole system has been created because the states are like, hey, we're going to do this. Don't bother us. It's just going to be in our state. And it's hard to ignore when almost every state is doing a medical program and almost half the states have full adult use.
So now let's talk about legislation. You mentioned SAFE. SAFE Banking passed 7 times in the House and never in the Senate. This time they are proposing that the legislation be presented to both houses at the same time. I know you were very positive on SAFE last year. It didn't happen. But what are your views on SAFE now? And what are the odds that it will pass this year in your opinion?
So I was hopeful for SAFE.
Yep.
I thought there were 2 windows last year where it could pass. It missed both of those windows. And it's one of the reasons why I'm like, look, it would be great if SAFE passed. I'm not counting on it anymore. I'm not making any predictions. And one of the things I realized is it really isn't in the problem cannabis has. It hasn't been politicians like to be elected and reelected. And if an issue isn't driving that, they'll talk to it, but not much will happen. And SAFE Banking appears to have momentum. I hope it passes. I have no idea if it's going to pass this time. I do believe that for the first time, because of the scheduling review process that the Biden administration controls, it is in President Biden's interest to move and to be aggressive on cannabis. And that is where I'm focused, not so much on the legislative side, but on the administration side, where they could lower it to a Schedule 3 or just try to deschedule it. And it's in his political interest. What is the political interest? One, he's made promises that he was going to do some version of this. But two, Biden is 81, and he is an elderly person that has had some pretty public falls. I don't know how you run for president without taking an issue and trying to look young. And I think that this is the equivalent of a $20 or $100 bill laying on the ground for the Biden administration to pick up and to basically say, we're going to move on cannabis reform and look at us. We're kind of hip to the times. And I think there's almost no downside to it. So, and potentially quite a bit of upside to his administration, especially before the primaries, where even though he isn't being opposed by many people, you still don't want any close primaries. You don't want him to be bruised. You want people to be, and this is why I think he moved so aggressively on student loans, which just got shot down from the Supreme Court justice. And so I think finally we have an opportunity here where a person in power has it in his political interest to move on cannabis and has the power to do so unilaterally. So, you know, in summary, it's nice to read about SAFE. I hope it happens, but the implications of the Biden administration. And there's one other thing is that Merrick Garland, the U.S. Attorney General, is due to put out a new memo on cannabis and has promised it for a while. And there's a lot of things that he could write in that memo that would get you pretty close to SAFE Banking. And he has the power. If the Department of Justice in the U.S. decides they're not going to go after state legal businesses, well, in that is a huge win for the industry and could encourage a lot more capital to enter the space.
Absolutely. So do you expect this memorandum from Merrick Garland to come out anytime soon?
Yeah, by year end. Okay. I was expecting it sooner. I would expect it in the fall. I know this by law, the human health secretary is running the descheduling process. It's supposed to come out with the scientific review by December 2nd. I expect the Biden administration on a number of levels to make a number of announcements on cannabis by year end.
Got it. And well, you mentioned that cannabis is Schedule 1, which is a joke, and fentanyl is Schedule 2. And just going back to this review, this schedule review, you wrote a fantastic piece last year in your Substack that I recommend everyone to read, in which you look at each one of the people involved with this decision. So in your opinion, do you think that everything will, well, this schedule or reschedule will happen this year?
I think they'll start the process this year. That's my opinion, but I could be wrong. Right. Look, because in the end, it's politics and they're politicians and you never know. But my own sense is politicians like to get elected and reelected. And I think that they have to move on this, and it's in their interest to move on it. So we'll see. But I very much believe you're going to have movement on this. And the reason why you're so focused on this and the reason why you would want to be interested in the sector is there are investments that, Marcelo, you and I are invested in where it's not like they go up 50%. Like some of these companies could go up 10 or 20 times. So the reason why you pay attention to this stuff is the magnitude, the asymmetry of the upside is what is so compelling.
I agree. Aaron, one of the things that can be done is a crackdown on illegal production. When I was traveling around the U.S. last year, I saw many illegal stores. And closing the stores and facilities would be good for the states because they will collect more taxes. It would be good for consumers who would be certain of the quality of the products that they are buying. And it would be good for investors like us. Why do you think states do not get tougher on illegal growers? And what can we expect in the future?
You've asked a very complicated question. I'm not sure I am the resident expert to be able to answer that, but I will give my own two cents.
Yeah.
Is you have to understand the history of cannabis, and that cannabis production and sale of cannabis has been going on for a very long time in the US, despite the illegality, despite the war on drugs. People love smoking cannabis, okay? And they have for a very long time. For pain relief, for a bunch of different issues, you know, reasons just to enjoy it. And so then imagine that you came along and then you said, okay, I'm a state. And let's say I'm the state of New Jersey. Okay. And I say, I'm going to grant certain people licenses and I'm going to restrict the number of licenses and then I'm going to legalize it. And then all of a sudden, all the people in New Jersey can now legally go into the store. So you have a lot of people that would never break the law, or maybe a friend would have it and they take a smoke, but now they're like, oh, I'd love to go in a store. But what they find is that the price is really high. The quality is very inconsistent and it's like, meh. And then you have the people who are regular users who have been buying in the illicit market before it was legalized. They're getting California or Oregon cannabis from their weed seller. And they're paying half or 40% of the price of this mediocre, inconsistent, sometimes moldy cannabis. What would you do? What would we expect them to do? What would we expect the residents of New York who have been smoking weed for God knows how long to do? Then, as from the government, a lot of the governments have overcrowded jails, have overcrowded things. They're getting pummeled on every side. There's too much crime. You're waging a war against minorities and don't know what to do. And then they're looking at it and they're like, hey, it's pretty obvious the U.S. has used the war on drugs to target minority. We even have it from the former advisor to President Nixon that this was used to target the African American community and the hippies against the Vietnam War. So we know it. And it's, And so there's the people that are now running the governments. A lot of the cities themselves are run by normally progressive people. And they're looking at it and they're like, we're not going to perpetuate the war on drugs because it's really a war on people. Now, whether they're making the right decision or not, they're coming from, we just spent decades fighting people and incarcerating them and demonizing the plant. And now they're struggling with, how do you legalize it and make people operate in a legal system, but don't go back to the same old, you see, so they're stuck. And then the other quandary they have is they're handing out licenses to people that were harmed by the war on drugs, people that were illicitly selling cannabis. They're handing out licenses. How do they then turn around and put people in jail for illegally selling cannabis? So it's not an easy answer. And I think part of it is, how do you destroy the illicit market? You compete against it. You have the lowest price of cannabis. You don't try to stranglehold the market and create an artificial market where people are paying artificially high prices. You don't grow cannabis in a place where it costs $1,000 to $2,000 a pound when you can grow it outdoors in Oregon for $100 or $150 a pound.
Yep.
To me, it all comes back to the main issue that I told you is interstate commerce. We shouldn't be trying to create all these little farms and convince people. You know this, Marcelo. Farming is the hardest business in the world. It is the most subsidized business in the world. Why? It depends on scale. It depends on technology, access to crazy amounts of capital. And so how you would be creating small farms and not try to do this at scale. And then what we should be doing is pushing people towards the distribution, towards retail, towards brands, towards edibles, towards products, and try to encourage this massive low-cost supply that can come from the West. But we're not doing that. We're trying to fit a square block into a round hole and being like, why isn't this working? Why? I don't understand. Why won't people stop buying from the illicit market? And it's like, why won't people reverse decades of behavior? It's absurd.
Yep. Good answer. Now, another item that can completely change the landscape of the sector, as you mentioned before, is interstate commerce. Today, companies have to grow cannabis in each state they participate, which you mentioned is crazy. What are the chances that we see interstate commerce over the next couple of years? Let me say illegal interstate commerce.
So right now I would say it's happening. Just because, I mean, you can tell it's happening. You go to New York City and there's like California weed everywhere. But it's like, you just can't have the price differential be that great, right? You just can't. You can't have it. People will figure out ways to get it there. And so what I would say is, one, my research, and this is based on Vanderbilt Law Professor, who's done a lot of work in this, and others, is that the interstate commerce restrictions are unconstitutional. So the states have created interstate commerce restrictions by saying, hey, we know it's federally legal, but we're just going to do it in our state, so don't bother us. And then what they've said is, well, there's interstate commerce restrictions because it's federally illegal. And I understand why they do it. They did it. But my understanding, it is only up to Congress to regulate commerce. And according to 80 years of federal court rulings, there's no difference to the federal courts between interstate commerce, just between states, and intrastate commerce, which is inside the state. And so they don't care. Like, if something's federally illegal, like if someone was producing, let's say cocaine, and then selling it in LA, I produced it and sold it in LA, the federal government wouldn't care if I did that in LA or I sold it to New York City. It's all the same, right? And if you think about the creation of the United States, it's really between this federation of states. The United States was created so that someone from Pennsylvania couldn't say, oh, I don't want New York corn. That doesn't work for me. You know, that's the whole basis of the United States. And there's a part of the understanding of the Constitution, which is the Dormant Commerce Clause. You just can't do that. And the federal illegality has kind of caused, you know, and now there's arguments of what constitutes an interstate commerce. And does the interstate commerce refer to a product that's federally illegal? There's all these complicated questions. The minute you move it to like Schedule 3 or you deschedule it, there literally is no basis for interstate commerce restrictions. And I think the more that we see these markets develop, what will happen is you're going to have court cases. If the federal government doesn't move on this, you're going to see court cases. You're going to see other people basically hammering home that this violates the Constitution. And so I think that a likelihood is very high in the next couple of years that you're going to get interstate commerce. And you may get like interstate commerce pacts, which is states agreeing to trade with each other.
Right.
But eventually you're going to want a national market and you're going to want the best providers and the lowest cost. Look, when you go to Colorado or New York, can you find that craft beer manufacturer that is the local favorite? Of course, same thing will happen with cannabis. But in general, we know what people buy, and they buy from the big beer companies, and they produce it in one or two locations. And that's how it goes.
Got it. Now, if interstate commerce passes and becomes a thing, would that allow U.S. companies to import cannabis from other countries? What would prevent U.S. companies from importing cannabis from Colombia or Canada, for instance?
I think you'd need international trade agreements and a lot of things, but I don't think any. And this is the other thing is I think U.S. cannabis is going to go everywhere. And I've heard arguments that are like, oh, my God, the minute that it's legalized, you'll have international, you'll have Colombian. And then I go ahead and say, I have a friend who's living in Berlin. Okay. He said Berlin is Germany is now legalizing cannabis. They're going through this painful process of the same thing the US is of legalizing it. He literally picks up his phone. He gets daily menus from somebody selling either weed from Portugal, Spain, California. He'll text them what he wants, drive up to his apartment building. He'll get in the car. They'll hand it to him. He'll pay for it. Drive around the block, drop him off. He can get California cannabis in Berlin. And I love reading stories of like in Mexico, in Tijuana on the border, hottest selling cannabis is California cannabis. Wait a minute. Why? And then in Thailand, all the Thai cultivators of cannabis, which just legalized, are complaining that there's too much California cannabis in Thailand.
Wow.
And then you're like, wait, why? Because that's where you make cannabis. That's where it's really good. They've been doing it for decades. They know what the best strains are. They know how to do it. They know how to market it. And when people think, you know, where do you buy wine? I don't buy wine from Colombia. I don't buy wine from Georgia, the state of Georgia. Or, you know, where I buy wine? I buy wine from France. I may buy it from Australia. Definitely buy it from California. And it's like, it's part of the brand, part of the quality, part of the just ability of having amazing, perfect weather that you can grow it here. And so I think this is, and I hear the stories from around the world, and it's like U.S. cannabis is going to go everywhere. So it's a global thing. Now, man, you'll have some producers in some South American countries that'll make like the lowest cost stuff that'll be an input for like distillates and stuff. Yeah, that'll be a thing, but not the kind of stuff that people want to smoke and they want to show their friend, oh, what did you get? Oh man, I have this great California. Part of when you consume something or you're sharing something is you signaling. I don't walk into a bar and say, I want beer. You may ask, what do you have on tap? And then it'll be like, oh, I just want beer. I don't care. Give me the Colombian beer. Yeah, maybe in Colombia you'll do that.
Got it. Got it. Fantastic. And Aaron, I like to ask guests to give us some book recommendations. Is there anything you're reading now or any great books that you recommend us to read in addition to The Heartbreak?
Oh, my book. Yeah, no. So thank you for referencing. I wrote a book that makes a business case for the Sabbath of basically taking one day off. And every Friday night to Saturday night, I turn my phone and computer off and it's saved my life. I highly recommend it. A book that I've read recently. You know, I have this one book that I would recommend people to buy. I'm a value investor, and that's one of the reasons I love cannabis is the valuations are so low. It's crazy. But there's this one book right here that's like a collection of Buffett and Munger talks. And it says, all I want to know is where I'm going to die, so I'll never go there. And it's basically a convert. They've done it between a conversation between Buffett and Munger. So they've assembled all these different talks that they've given, and it's all this wisdom that I personally feel like you can learn so much from Buffett and Munger, and that's one recent book that I'd recommend.
Nice, absolutely. I really like Charlie Munger. The book you're seeing behind me there is Poor Charlie's Almanac.
Oh yeah, I have that too. Oh, right over here.
Yeah, it's just there below the map.
Oh, and, so there's one last thing. There's one last thing. It's related to that. One of the great insights from Munger is he goes ahead and this is why you and I are very focused on companies that are showing operational excellence and cultivation and being the lowest cost producer, right? Like we talk about this offline a lot. There's this amazing quote that Munger has. He says there's two companies. One is a copper producer that produces at $2.50 a pound. And then there's a copper producer that produces at $1.50 a pound. And this is just an example of what you can learn from them and how you can apply it to future industries. So one at $2.50, one at $1.50. He said, when the price of copper is at $2 a pound, it's as if those two companies are in two totally different industries. Yep. And I can tell you that when you, if any of your listeners and people start researching cannabis, that is one of the great insights you can make, is that right now what's going on in cannabis, it is as if there are two different industries.
That's absolutely true, actually. Aaron, once again, many thanks for coming to this program and sharing your insights with us. I'm sure many people will benefit from your views, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
If you like this podcast, feel free to forward it to your friends and colleagues. We appreciate your time, support, and your feedback. You can follow Marcelo Lopez on Twitter at MALopez1975. The information presented here is not investment advice and should not be taken as such. You should do your own due diligence and consult with your financial advisor before doing anything suggested or mentioned in this podcast. L2 Capital and its partners will not be liable for any losses that occur in doing whatever is discussed in this podcast.
This podcast was edited by Aerolitus Smart Edition.